And I see some familiar faces from last night. We had a good time here. I did anyway. Hope you did. Of all the ways you could spend Saturday night in Boulder, Colorado, to come to church, that was impressive. And this is quite an assignment. Justice, mercy, humility, each one of these words requires a whole week, and I'm sure you'll get a whole week. I'm a journalist. I'm a storyteller, so I'll leave the theology to the cleanup hitters, which will come in the next few weeks. But I'm just going to mainly tell you some stories, some of which are in the Bible, and some of them are more contemporary, because that's my job as a journalist. But I'm going to start this morning by, I'm focusing on this word mercy, which is close to the word grace, and I have thought a lot and written a lot about that word. And I want to start with an image. Here we live in Colorado. Beautiful day, another beautiful day here. And we are so blessed to be in the midst of God's creation. And one of the images I have of grace and mercy comes from water, the way it always flows down. Have you noticed that? There's something about gravity. So that water, no matter where it starts, always flows down to the lowest part. And I think that's the way grace and mercy work as well. So I brought some images. Many of them are from John Fielder that just, I hope, will imprint in your mind that pattern. It starts up, we live on Upper Bear Creek Road, Bear Creek in Evergreen, Colorado, and I've been to the place where Upper Bear Creek starts. It's up in Mount Evans. You can stand there, and if you have a telescope, actually see my house. And the water starts this time of year. You don't even see water, but because it's been so warm, you may hear it. You can stand on top of an ice field and hear that beautiful gurgling sound underneath. There's water under there, and that's the beginning of the creek where I live. But water always flows down, 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 and it melts, and in the next couple of months, it spills over, forms these beautiful lakes that if you climb any of the mountains around here. How many have climbed Long's Peak? All right, yeah. Well, you know what it's like. You're hot, and then you turn a corner, and you see one of these beautiful lakes, and it's just so refreshing. You want to stop and take in the view. But even then, water keeps flowing down, so it spills over those lakes and cuts through grasses, cuts through whatever is there. It cuts through rock, the Grand Canyon. Water flows down, and eventually it gets all the way down to where I live, a couple thousand feet below, 7,000 feet below where it started on Mount Evans, and then it's a river. It's like this, and in the spring and June, particularly, it will be a flowing river where people have drowned in Bear Creek. This nice little trout stream behind my home becomes a torrent, and it keeps going down, and finally, it ends up in a lake in downtown Denver. They put up a dam to stop all that water, and they canoe on it, and sailboat and wave runners and things like that. That's the image that I want to leave you with, because mercy is that down, down, down to the lowest part. That was easily shown in the life of Jesus. The Roman Empire was a stratified society. It was top down. So I brought you a list of the way the social structure in the Roman Empire worked. Number one at the very top was Caesar. And some of the phrases they used, the titles of Caesar, were Lord and Son of God. So, of course, when Jesus started using these words, that was pretty inflammatory. And I'm sure that made its way up to the Roman authorities there. And then below that is the governing class, the Sadducees, who make appearances now and then in the Gospels. They were part of that governing class. They were collaborating with Rome. Next, what was called the retainer class. Pharisees were in that class, just a little bit below. Priests, bureaucrats, that's the retainer class. And then down to merchants, and then peasants. 75% of the people were peasants, but that's the way a stratified society works. It's not a majority vote. These were the guys out there actually doing the work, but they didn't have much status. And then at the very bottom, nobodies, people who were unclean, those with leprosy, people who were expendable, slaves. There are still slaves today, as you're finding out in the next few weeks. So that's how it worked in Rome. And if you go and look at the Gospels, what you see is that Jesus turned this upside down. For one thing, he claimed these titles, Lord, Son of God, so you would expect him to act like a Caesar, but no. How did he respond to the Roman authorities? Well, he didn't really have much room for politics. The few times he made political statements, somebody asked him about King Herod. He said, ah, that fox. And then he actually was interviewed by Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, and Pilate couldn't get him to talk. He said, come on, defend yourself. They're about to kill you. And Jesus would not respond. He wasn't very impressed with the impressive people in the Roman structure. The Sadducees, the Pharisees, read the Gospels. They were the enemies. They were the ones that he opposed. And you read these fierce words in the Gospels about how they're unwashed graves and they're hypocrites and snakes and vipers and stuff like that. He just didn't really have. And when he went to the priests, he went to the temple and overturned the tables and chased them out because they were charging money for Gentiles to go pray. That's not right. This is supposed to be a house of prayer for all nations, and you're excluding people from meeting God. And Jesus said, I'm not going to go with that injustice. I'm going to overturn it. And he actually did overturn it. So you look at Jesus, and you can almost reverse. These are the ones he spent most of his time with. It was those with leprosy. It was the woman with an issue of blood. It was the cripples. It was the demon-possessed. Those, the nobodies. Jesus spent most of his time. And these are the people who were following him around trying to trap him and eventually did and eventually killed him, crucified. So here's the great stratified Roman status, social status, and Jesus turned it upside down. Okay, what would that look like today? Who would be at the very top? Well, actually, I was going to say senior pastors would be at the very top, right? But celebrities, athletes, rock stars, the Kardashians, I don't know what it is about them, but I read, you know, the NBA playoffs are going on, and there are several stars in the NBA, and these are very skilled. You watch these guys, I mean, their job is to put a round ball in a round hoop, you know, and they're really good at that. And I read there are several NBA stars who make more money in a year than the entire United States Senate combined. And some of you think, well, they deserve more money. Senate's not doing much these days. But, I mean, think about it. What does that say about our society that we value putting a round ball in a round hoop more than all the people who write our laws? Huh. That's interesting. Okay, so they're number one. CEOs, hedge fund managers, Wall Street, Silicon Valley. When I graduated from high school, the average CEO in a big corporation made 20 times what the average employee made. You know what it is now? It's 300 times. So if you work for a large company and you make, let's say, $40,000 a year, on average, your CEO would make $12 million a year. So there you go, right at the top. Next are the professionals. They used to be kind of at the top, you know, airline pilots, doctors, people like that, but they've been outstripped by the CEOs and the Kardashians. And then below that, the service class, you say teachers, social workers, CDOT employees, garbage workers. Actually, in many cities, I put that in on purpose because garbage collectors in many cities make the same as teachers. What does that say about our society? Huh. And then if you keep going down, military, oh, they're great. They give their lives for our country. So we don't pay them. We send them overseas. They come back missing limbs and we don't really care for them, and they commit suicide. That's how much we value the military. And then at the very bottom, our nobodies, the homeless, undocumented workers. We hear about those a lot these days. As you will see in the next few weeks, especially if you go to Erie, this third world experience, you will see that in some societies, there are even classes below that, below those nobodies. And I have, because I'm a journalist and I travel overseas, I've seen a lot of that. A few weeks ago, really, just last month, we went to Hawaii. I was speaking in Honolulu, and we thought, well, let's see, we could go to Maui, or we could go to Kauai, And my wife says, why don't we go to Molokai? Well, what's in Molokai? Anybody been to Molokai? Yeah, what's in Molokai? There's a leprosy colony there. She said, you've written books about leprosy. I wrote three books with a doctor, Paul Brand, who was a leprosy specialist. And so we went to Molokai. It was a very stirring trip. Molokai, it's Hawaii, you know, it's paradise. I brought a picture, and this is what it looks like. It's just this beautiful peninsula. You can kind of see some buildings here. And in that peninsula, in the 1830s, 1840s, there was really nobody living on Molokai. And behind this peninsula, there's this huge wall, 3,000 feet. There's no road. You can't get a road. So we took this trail, 26 switchbacks, kind of like climbing a 14er, 3,000 feet. And then here's the place that was the leprosy colony. People were very afraid of leprosy. Of course, it does things to your body that make you look unappealing. And so they would just take these leprosy patients and dump them. Sometimes they couldn't even land the boat. They would just kick them out in the surf, and some of them drowned on the way, and some of them made it to shore. And there were thousands, several thousand of these leprosy patients, and they lived in squalor. They lived in complete anarchy. There was no marriage. There was no government. There was crime. There was raping, all this stuff going on. And then this Belgian priest came, Father Damien. And Father Damien came and said, well, this is not right. And he started to organize these people. One of the first things he started to do was honor the dead. In those days, they were just burying them in an open pit. And he said, no, that's not right. These are human beings. And they've restored some of the original graves. You can see that wall of cliffs, why they thought, well, that's a good place for a leprosy colony because then nobody can get near it. Nobody will be affected by the leprosy people. And Father Damien and this woman whose name was Marianne started organizing. Father Damien built 600 houses out of the lava rock in Hawaii. He built schools, orphanages, clinics, churches. Three of his churches are still there. And it's now a national park. It's run by the National Park Service. There are 8 patients left. That's all. There used to be as many as 10,000 over the years. And now there are only 8 left, and as soon as they die, they're all pretty old, it will be just a national park. And it was so moving as we went through these museums we saw the display of what it used to be like and what this priest, this Belgian high-class priest, understood his role was. His role was to go down like water. Mercy flows to the lowest part. He went to the lowest people on earth, people with leprosy. Nobody wanted to be anywhere near them. We'll throw them on a peninsula that's walled off and change their lives. And as recently as 2009, he was finally sainted. He was made a saint by the Catholic Church, as was Marianne. I remember reading as I was working on the history of leprosy. In the Middle Ages, there was a strange rumor. This is the Middle Ages, and there was a strange rumor that Jesus had leprosy. You know, that's kind of weird. Why would they come up with that? Well, there's a description, actually the only physical description of Jesus that we know. We don't know whether he was short, tall, blonde, brown, you know, probably not blonde, being Jewish. But we don't know. The biographers didn't tell us, strangely enough. The only thing like a description is a prophecy in Isaiah 52:53. And it says that he was disfigured beyond that of any man, like one from whom you turn your face. And somebody was reading that in the Middle Ages and said, huh, the only people I know like that are lepers. They're people who have leprosy. So Jesus must have had leprosy. And they also knew that passage in Matthew 25, that if you've done it unto the least of these, my brothers, you've done it unto me. So they said, we need to go find some people with leprosy and treat them as if they were Jesus. And so they started doing that. And this in Europe, in those days, there were a lot of people with leprosy. They lived outside of town in caves or, you know, in dungeons, and nobody would associate with him. And they said, that's not right. We wouldn't treat Jesus like that. So they started building these beautiful little homes and clinics. They were called Lazarettos, after Lazarus, who was in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. Some people thought he had leprosy. So that's what they called them. There were 2,000 in France, 2,000 of these Lazarettos. There were 20,000 in Europe. This was a big deal. And gradually, because of the care and the compassion in reaching out to the leprosy victims, leprosy pretty much disappeared from Europe. There's no leprosy in Europe today. There's still a lot in third world countries, maybe 12 million people who have leprosy, but not in Europe. And to me, that's a beautiful model of what if we, one by one, picked homeless people or people caught up in sexual trafficking or people with Ebola or whatever, and said, why don't we treat them like we would treat Jesus? Could we have the same effect on those problems as was had on leprosy over the years? Mother Teresa used to say, that's what I do. When I see a beggar, a dying beggar on the streets of Calcutta, I see not the beggar, I look for the face of Jesus. And she said, sometimes Jesus appears to me in the most distressing disguise. But my job is to treat them as if they were Jesus. Because Jesus said, if you've done it to one of these, the least of these, my brothers, the nobodies, you've done it unto me. Jesus, I have spent some time in leprosy colonies. I've visited hospitals. I remember one time I went to Nepal, a little country right next to India. And one of the thrilling things is that virtually every advance in the treatment of leprosy, the understanding, came about from Christian missionaries. Not necessarily because they were the best scientists and doctors, but because they were the only ones willing to work with leprosy patients. It was such a feared disease, and they found out it really didn't need to be that feared. It was pretty easily treated, and it's not that contagious. But nobody knew that, so they didn't want to be around those kind of people who were disfigured like that. But the missionaries did, and because they were with them on a daily basis, they eventually understood how the disease worked. And wherever I've gone, and there are leprosy, there's a colony of leprosy patients, it's almost always run by Christians. So I went to one of these in Nepal. It was called the Good Shepherd, I think it was the Good Shepherd Hospital. And we were being given a tour by a doctor there. As we walked through the hospital, there was an open courtyard, and across the courtyard, quite a distance, I saw this woman who had been ravaged by the disease. I got to tell you, she was one of the least attractive human beings I've ever seen. Her eyes were crusted over. She had been blind for years, covered with scabs because they don't feel pain. So she'll rub her eyes, and it will grow scar tissue. And her fingers had worn away, just nubs. Her feet were bandaged. She also had no toes. And her nose had shrunken away so that when you look at her, you actually looked into her skull. It was not a pretty sight at all. And she was way over in the end of the courtyard. And we kept having this tour. The doctor was showing us around. Here's the chapel. Here's the whatever. And it took about half an hour. When we came back, this woman had dragged herself over to the sidewalk where we had been walking. She couldn't walk. But she would move kind of like an animal. She'd plant her elbows and then drag her body behind her. And she made it all the way across that courtyard. She had heard our voices and wanted to know what was going on. So I saw this woman right next to the sidewalk now, and I figured, oh, she must be a beggar, because what else can you do if you have leprosy in a country like Nepal? And I reached into my pocket to see if I had some coins maybe I could give her. And my wife had a much different reaction. Janet worked in among the low, among the nobodies, the poor in Chicago for years. She ran a project with the impoverished senior citizens. And she had a completely different and more holy reaction. She went over to this woman and put her arm around her, and the woman started singing. And we didn't know Nepali. But we didn't have to know Nepali. We knew the tune. She started singing, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. The doctor said to us, oh, I want you to meet Don Maya. Don Maya is no beggar. Don Maya is the closest thing to a saint that we have here. Every time the church door is open, she's there. In fact, Philip, do you have any prayer requests? Because Don Maya's prayers get answered. And I went away. First convicted my first reaction to Don Maya, and then also just amazed at the wonder that Don Maya, who by that social status ladder that I showed you is way at the bottom. No beauty, no money, no career, no resume, very little as a human being. And yet God said, I can make a very comfortable home in that woman. She's the closest thing to a saint that I know, the doctor told us. That's how Jesus can treat and transform people who are the nobodies, people who are at the low. And that's what mercy does, is you've seen the projects that you're going to be attempting here now. Reaching out, grace, mercy always flows down like water to the lowest part. It's not just people in the social status, it's people in the moral status too. I'm always struck by the fact that it's the sinners who wanted to be around Jesus. The religious people were challenging him. The political people were threatened by him. It was the sinners who were attracted to him. There's one scene, you know about it, in where a woman is caught in the very act of adultery. She's brought to Jesus. People aren't really that concerned about the crime. They're trying to trap Jesus, so they throw this trap, they think, at Jesus. Whenever you think you've trapped Jesus, watch out. It's going to spring right back on you. And that happened here, and here's one of the movies that shows that scene. And I'm sure the people in that scene thought, well, there are two kinds of people here. There are good people like us. We're the Pharisees. We keep the law. We're righteous people, holy people. And then there are bad people like that slut. Good people, bad people. And Jesus looked at the same scene, and I think this is how he would see it. There are people who are in need of grace and admit it, like this woman here. She had no defense. And then there are people who are in need of God's mercy who don't admit it. And I mentioned last night that grace is a free gift of God. You can't do anything to deserve it, earn it. It's mercy. It flows down to the lowest part. But the way to receive a gift, you have to have your hands open. If you don't have your hands open, the gift falls to the ground. And so many of the Pharisees and the religious people in Jesus' day had their hands closed tight like a fist and missed God's grace. They missed the whole message. And that's true not only in Jesus' day, it's true today as well. I spoke once to, I got a phone call from this guy saying, could you speak in a couple months? I said, no, I plan my schedule a lot longer in advance than that. He said, well, yeah, I figured that, but you are a journalist. You're probably always looking for new experiences, right? I said, well, that's true. He said, well, before you say no, there are going to be 100 prostitutes there. Said, oh, wow. I've never met a prostitute. That's interesting. He said, actually, they're former prostitutes. These were people who, from 40 different countries, women, who were caught up in sexual trafficking, and they've been ministered to, they've been converted, and they're coming together, and they have such a hard time understanding God's grace, given their backgrounds. We wonder if you would come speak to them about grace. They're going to be in Wisconsin. And I said, wow, I guess I would like to have that experience, but only if I don't just speak. I would also like to listen. Could you arrange a time where we sit together and I hear their stories? He said, sure, no problem. So I'll never forget. It was a kind of a classroom setting with tiered seats and 100 prostitutes and me. And they, one by one, told their story. And they were wrenching, poignant stories. It's not like you see on TV. It's not glamour. It's shame and degradation and addiction and abuse. And I heard story after story, especially from these third world countries. And then finally, I told them, did you know that the Bible talks about you? And some of them didn't know that. They're new Christians. And I talked about Barris, the prostitute who came and anointed Jesus' feet with perfume and washed with her hair. And the fact that Jesus said that the prostitutes and tax collectors will come first in the kingdom of heaven ahead of the religious professionals, like the Pharisees. I said, why do you think he chose you? Why didn't he talk about, you know, shoemakers or why prostitutes? And you could see them kind of thinking. And this one woman from Bulgaria with not so good English raised her hand and she said, you know, Everybody, she has somebody looked down on, except us. We are at the low, the very bottom. She said, nobody's mom says, honey, when you grow up, I want you to be best prostitute in town. So our families, they kick us out. Most of us, we don't know our family now. But sometimes, she said, when you're at the low, you cry for help. And God's grace, God's mercy, like water, always flows down, down, down to the low. There's another word in that verse from Micah 6:8, and that's justice. And I found a chapter, Luke 18, that pulls together some of these concepts, in fact, all of these, mercy and humility and justice. There are two main scenes in the first part of the chapter. One is Jesus is on a trip. He's going to Jericho. I guess it's Luke 18, 19. Jesus is going on a trip. He passes through Jericho, and right when he enters the town, he plans just to walk through the town, but there's a big crowd, words out, celebrities here, big teacher, rabbis here, so everybody's around, and the VIP, the mayor of the town. And right when he walks in, this beggar interrupts him. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, he says. And the crowd says, hey, shut up. Don't you realize who this is? This is a very important person. This is a prophet. Get out of here. He doesn't have time for beggars, but of course Jesus does, always. He stops the procession, walks over, and meets this guy. His name is Bartimaeus. And if you read some of the commentaries, not all agree, but some of the commentaries say that Bartimaeus actually means son of garbage. Bart is son, and then Emmaus is garbage. So imagine, you know, you go to school. What's your name? Son of garbage. And Bartimaeus probably didn't go to school. He was blind. He was a beggar. Son of garbage. I mean, that's pretty low, right? And Jesus always has time. Always has time. And he walks over, deals with him like a human being. What's your problem? Well, I'm blind. I'd like to see. Oh, okay, I can fix that. And there's the act of mercy, Jesus, wherever he goes, and asks us to do the same. But that's not the only character in this passage. The next character is very different. It's Zacchaeus. Some of you may have grown up in Sunday school like I did, and we learned this little song, Zacchaeus was a wee little man, a wee little man was he. Yeah, I think it was written by Scottish. We don't use that. Wee little man, yeah. He was short. That's what we learn. And the reason people believe that is because he had to climb a tree, right, to see Jesus. Here's this big parade. It resumes after he takes care of Bartimaeus. And Zacchaeus was a tax collector. Very timely. Some of us filed taxes just last week, right? And but it was different back then, because tax collectors were collaborators with the Roman Empire, and they worked on commission. So whatever you got a percentage of. You got like 30% of it. And so it's not like, you know, this is your standard, this is how much you pay. I would try to fleece you for anything you've got, and then I get 30% of it. So the more taxes I collect, the better. And what do I do with those taxes? I pay Roman Empire with these troops who are the occupying force. So tax collectors were very unpopular people. They were considered like traitors. You're a Jew, but you're ripping off other Jews to support the occupying army. I mean, so I think the reason Zacchaeus climbed a tree was because that was the safest place in town. If he had been down there, hey, let's get this guy. Finally, we got him. There are a bunch of us. And so that's the oppressor. We've already seen the oppressed, Bartimaeus, how Jesus handles that. How do you handle the oppressor? And that's a justice issue that you'll be dealing with. And sure enough, Jesus says, hey, Zacchaeus, most unpopular person in town, I'd like to come to your house for dinner tonight. Oh, really? No one else has ever wanted to come to my house. And Jesus shows how you treat an oppressor. You treat him like a human being. And one of the clues to justice is convert the oppressors. Because by the end of that dinner with Jesus, Zacchaeus is taking out loans to repay all the people that he's ripped off over the years. It's a beautiful story, just like that. And it doesn't solve the whole problem, but it solves his particular problem. I was speaking in my church in Evergreen one time, and I was speaking on prayer. I was talking about this prayer, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. I said, I realize I've never done that before. Here we live through the Cold War. Russia had missiles pointed at us, and I never once prayed for Russia. I mean, those are the enemies. And then I said, well, who are our enemies now? And I brought you some pictures, and I showed them pictures of people from Al-Qaeda. And I said, well, what would happen these are our enemies. They're trying to kill us. What would happen if every church in the United States adopted one of these people, learned to pronounce his name, and started praying for him? Didn't Jesus ask us to do that? Well, I didn't know it, but there was a colonel in the army from Fort Carson who had driven up 2 hours for this meeting. He heard me speak, and that really bothered him because he'd been in Iraq, he'd been in Afghanistan, and he tried to kill enemies, but he never prayed for them. And he took that very seriously. So he went home and started a website, and you can still sign up. The website is called ATFP.org, Adopt a Terrorist for Prayer. And you can go, and there's a little profile and a picture, and you can find a terrorist, and you have to agree to pray. That's one thing that we can do for the oppressors that you would only get from the Gospels. So why would you do it? You should read the comments he gets on his website. You idiot! We should kill these people. We should wipe them out. He said, I'm a colonel. I do help do that, but I'm also praying for them. Why would anybody come up with such a crazy idea as loving your enemies? And Jesus answered that question. This is what he said. So that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. The more we love and the more unlikely people we love and show mercy to, the more we are like God. Because that's what God is like. God loves us. Ornery people that we are. And if we can find people who are as distant from us as God is from us, those are the ones who we should show mercy to be like God. There's a beautiful passage that was kind of a hymn in the early church in Philippians 2, and it said, it tells the story of Jesus who had all the prerogatives of the Godhead, and yet he set them aside and became a man, not just a man, but a servant. Not just a servant, but one who died. Not just one who died, but one who died on a cross. And that's the pattern. Mercy always flowing down, down, down like water. Some people could say this whole series you've got going, in 5 weeks, whatever, these projects, man, I couldn't keep them all straight. You guys are really locked in here. You know, you could, okay, you've already got a gym. You used to have a gym. I guess you converted it to a cafe now. You have a cafe. What about a swimming pool? Wouldn't it be great for this church to have a swimming pool? You could have outreach. You know, that would really increase your youth program. Why would you care about these people, the artwork in the gym right now? Why don't you use your money for that? Well, because we're called to be like God, children of the Father, who causes rain to fall and the sun to shine on the righteous and unrighteous alike. God who shows mercy that always goes down. God who was powerful. God who was deserving, but set it aside and became one of us. As a journalist, I've seen how this works. There's one more reason. One reason to do what you're doing is to be like God, because we're commanded to do that. The other reason, it's a funny thing, as you do that, it actually helps you. It does. As a journalist, I look back at the people I've interviewed, and they tend to fall into two categories. One category I'll call stars, and those are the Kardashians and the celebrities and the Lady Gagas and the Justin Biebers, and, you know, I've gotten to know some of those people over the years. I've interviewed them, not those particular people, but people like them. And, you know, nosy journalist, I'll go, could I go to your bathroom? And I look in their medicine cabinet. I see how many pills it takes to get them through one day. And I used to envy, man, wouldn't it be great to be Lady Gaga? Well, no, I don't think so. the pressures that these people live under. Often they become famous because there's a little voice inside them saying, you're no good. And they're convinced, I'm going to prove to the world that I'm not. And we've seen it again and again. Prince and Whitney Houston and, I don't need to tell you, Robin Williams, all these people, how it gets to them after a while. And then there are other people that I call the servants. And I love discovering and writing about these people. I told you I wrote three books with a leprosy doctor, the most brilliant person I know. He was offered head of orthopedics at Harvard and at Stanford. Turned them both down to do what? To work with leprosy patients in the most godforsaken place I've ever seen. This gravel pit in India. No one wanted to live next to a leprosarium. And Dr. Paul Brand came up with his great discoveries about leprosy in that place. And I've never met anyone who was more full of joy and gratitude. And it convinced me that Jesus was right. The most common statement that Jesus made in the Gospels six different times goes something like this. He said, you don't find your life by acquiring more and more. You find your life by giving it away in service to others. And when you do that, in the very process of giving it away, you find it. And I have seen that again and again in the servants. We start off thinking, okay, I guess I have to care about those people down, those nobodies, those people on this social ladder. And maybe I can be kind of like God in that particular way because I'm not like God in a lot of other ways. But in the very process of doing that, not only do you become like God, you become what God had in mind with the human race in the first place. That's how you find your life, by giving it away. There's a caution. You're in a town here. My wife was involved in urban work, and you kind of instinctively think, okay, if I'm doing this good deed, then God's going to reward me. And actually, it's hard stuff. Janet would, this is in Chicago, and this one grocery store would give free meat that they could make to feed the senior citizens, and she thought, oh, there's nowhere to park. If I just double park here just for 5 minutes, surely I won't get a ticket. I'm doing God's work. Every time she would get a ticket from the Chicago police. And the vans got broken into, and the church got robbed, and there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that when you do acts of mercy, you're going to have that instant reward. And in fact, the people that you work among, the most broken people, the addicts, the mentally ill, they're not all going to have triumphant stories that you'd write about in your church bulletin. There aren't that many victories. But we're called to be like God. We're called to show God's mercy that always flows down like water to the lowest part. Jesus' last lesson on before he left earth with his disciples was, I'd like to tell you about why I came, and now that I'm leaving, this is what I'd like you to do. And then he gave them an object lesson. He washed their feet. Hey, no, not me. You're the boss. You're not supposed to wash my feet. Yeah, that's what real leadership is to find dirty feet and wash them like the prostitute had done. What does the Lord require of us? Micah 6:8 says it very clearly, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. That humility, remember the direction of mercy like water. It always flows down. And as we do that, as we become more like God, we become more like the people God wants and God created. And in the process, we help bring justice to this messed up, broken planet. God be with you as you put into practice Micah 6:8. Amen.